going to talk today.
This is the UCLA Mindful Weekly Lecture.
Each week,
from Diana Winston, our classes,
one of our UCLA Mindful Teaching Retreats,
offers a talk about mindfulness
to deepen our understanding and cultivate well-being.
UCLA Mindful.
Thanks for joining us.
Join us each week for a new session on mindfulness.
There are probably hundreds of beautiful qualities that our heart can manifest and access, and all of them can be cultivated, and that's what we're going to talk about. But we're going to focus on four because there's sort of, as I said, there's kind of like a methodology around these four. So as we've probably talked about many times in here, is that much of what shapes our lives is not just what happens, but how we meet what happens. And two people can face the same event, loss or success or uncertainty or, anything, and have very different inner worlds. One person can contract, harden, self-blame, collapse. Another remains open, responsive, steady, spacious. So the question becomes then, what are the qualities of the heart and mind that allow us to meet life in a way that reduces suffering rather than amplifies it, that really helps us be present in the midst of life? So in the Buddhist tradition, there's a simple map, and it's called the Brahma Viharas. And the words translate as the heavenly abodes, or these beautiful places to live in. And they are, yes, it comes out of the Buddhist map, but it's also like this beautiful set of qualities that can be translated in a secular way and accessible to anyone, no matter what their background. So the four qualities, and some of them you're probably very familiar with, they kind of come as a package: loving kindness, compassion, appreciative joy, and equanimity. And so just to know a couple things about, I'm going to talk about each of them and talk about how they sort of fit together, but know that they're not beliefs. They're not like abstract concepts. They're actual states of being that we can embody, we can invite in, we can cultivate. They're relational capacities. They're ways of meeting our experience, ourselves and others. And as I've been saying, they are trainable. So even if you think you're a person who doesn't have a lot of one of these qualities, you can work on it through practices and develop them. Right now, I'm running a study with physicians where we're training in these four qualities, and it's called BEST, Building Emotional Strength Training. And it's been really wonderful. We've run one cohort of physicians. It's just been wonderful to see the response. Like, you can learn how to have more compassion for yourself and compassion for others and more equanimity and more joy and appreciation and kindness. Over 6 weeks, we have trained them, and we'll see the results once we go through a number of more cohorts, but it's very exciting to watch. So, we can hear this list and think, okay, this is about being just a nicer person, but it's really not. These qualities have, they're very impactful. So they can regulate and shape the nervous system. They have a cognitive impact and influence perception and interpretation of the world. They're relational, so they impact how we show up with others and how we relate. And they can become who we are. They can become a foundation of the way that we live our lives, and an embodiment. We can embody these qualities. So they're not just like abstract moral ideals, but they're functional capacities that shape resilience and clarity and connection. And so when you practice these, a lot of psychologists have looked at these, and scientists and researchers, they find that that when you have these qualities, as you practice them, either practicing them, or people who sometimes they study what's called state or trait. State is the evoking a quality, and trait are, it's stable, it's kind of part of a person. And you sometimes they'll do different studies looking at, do states lead to traits? Looking just at people who have these traits, looking at how we cultivate the states. There's lots of different ways to do scientific research. But in general, these qualities are associated with reduced stress and reactivity, more emotional regulation, greater social connection and well-being. And there's just a nice big body of research that's developing around them. And it's not as much research as the mindfulness research because it's, I don't know, the mindfulness sort of was what the scientists took to in the beginning, but now there's a lot on these four qualities. Or actually, there's not. There's a lot on loving kindness and compassion and much less on appreciative joy and equanimity. Actually, very little. But that's for scientists. If you're listening out there, do the research. Okay. So let's talk about the four different ones, and some of them will be familiar to you. The first is loving kindness. And sometimes you've heard the word metta, right? So that's in the Buddhist world, that's what they call it, metta. And it's this, in some ways, it's the simplest of the four. But it's quite radical in a way. And it's this basic stance of goodwill, the desire for another person to be happy or for oneself to be happy. To have peace and well-being and ease. And it's so these are the kinds of where we so one of the ways, as you know, because we've done this practice before, when we cultivate it, you use language and images and try to send these words to another being. There are multiple ways, many, many ways to cultivate it. But the thing to understand about it is that it's not we're not doing it, we're not sending kindness to another or because they deserve it or because it's earned, but it's more like an orientation towards kindness that is unconditional. So we can have a kindness that's not dependent on a person doing something for me or doing it right or getting, there's a lot of conditional loving out there. Most of our loving is conditional. This is considered an unconditional love, but that's a hard word because it's sort of hard to get there. But just keep that as like a North Star for this, like an orientation. Many people find it difficult to cultivate kindness, particularly towards themselves. So when you do the practices, we send kindness out to other beings. We can send it out to people we know, people we don't know, people we love. It's easiest, and I always start people with animals because if you're a pet person, dogs and cats are easy for most people. And then, so you can send it out in all different directions to different categories and types of people, but one of the ones that we send it to is ourselves. And that is surprisingly difficult sometimes for people, or maybe not surprisingly, it's understandably difficult. It's often touches into these places of our internalized criticism and self-hatred and sense of the self-worth. And so that's fine because it's a practice and it's something that we can cultivate. So I've taught classes on cultivating self-compassion. I think I did a day long on it a few months ago. And it's really a beautiful way that we can bring kindness to ourselves. So it's when the research has looked at loving kindness, it suggests that cultivating positive emotional states like care and warmth, cultivate something that, okay, there's a science researcher named Barbara Fredrickson, who's done a lot of research on loving kindness. And she says that one of the main things that kindness can do is it's called broaden attention. And what that means is that certain emotional states literally change how your mind takes in and processes the world. So when we face the world, when we're anxious, upset, angry, worried, not in a state of loving kindness, our attention narrows and we focus on threats and problems and what's wrong, and our thinking becomes more black and white, and you miss peripheral information. So if everyone does this just for a moment, is put your hand into a fist, but leave a little hole, and look at the world through that little tiny hole. This is what happens when our world narrows. And then when you start to practice loving kindness and other positive states, when I say three, release it. And you can see everything. One, two, three, release. Ah, the world is so much bigger than you thought. Right? You know this. I mean, how many times have you gotten in a fight with a partner, for instance, and the next thing you know, you're both really, really activated and you've both gone into this very narrow worldview and completely rigid black and white thinking. Oh no, we're never going to get out of this. This person is a jerk. They've done this to me. They've always done this to me. I'm never going to, right? That's narrowed thinking. I don't know if it happens to any of you. Never, ever happens to me. I'm joking. Of course it does. So when we practice these qualities, these beautiful qualities of the heart, we get that wider attention. You take in more context, more nuance. You see possibilities and options. Thinking becomes more flexible and creative. You're more aware of others and not just yourself. So this is amazing to think that we can transform our mind in just a moment of bringing in these qualities of loving kindness. Now, it's not like, I know you're in the midst of a fight with your spouse and you're like, okay, loving kindness, and then abracadabra, you feel all open and nuanced in your thinking. I mean, it doesn't work that way, right? It'd be nice if it did. But what it does do is it gives us that possibility. And that when we and you've all probably had the experience of maybe judging a person, narrow, they're this, and then something opens up your compassion or opens up your kindness, and suddenly it's not so rigid, right? We've had that experience. It happens to us. So we can cultivate it. I think Barb Fredrickson calls it the broaden and build effect. And positive states broaden your awareness in the moment, and over time, they build resources like resilience, healthy relationship, insight. So, in the context of loving kindness practice, you're not just being nice, you're training your mind to become more flexible, perceptive, and resourceful. And it doesn't just feel good, it changes how the mind operates. So that's pretty profound. And I will say this, that having done this practice and taught this practice, I've done it myself for, many decades, and I've taught it for also many decades, and I have seen it changes people. It's kind of amazing. Some of you have taken like my advanced loving kindness practice, or we used to teach sorts of positive emotion classes back in the day, UCLA Mindful and Mark. And people report that their stop always going to negativity, that their heart opens more, that they find they're having a kinder or more generous response than they used to. And it's through the practice. And like I said, there's a very specific practice that you've probably done with me. And if you haven't, it's the repetition of phrases, it's the opening to feeling people fe the feeling of it and letting that feeling grow. It's connecting to our own body. And we're going to practice this all in a little while, but just to say that it's a very specific practice that can cultivate this quality of kindness, just like all the other qualities can be cultivated too. So that's the first. Let's just tap into it for a moment. So I just invite you, if you want to close your eyes, you don't have to, but just take it for a moment and bring to mind, could be that person you admire that we had talked about earlier, or bring to mind your dog or cat or baby or best friend or someone that it's fairly easy to love. And you can sense them, feel them here in front of you. And take a breath. And as you think about them, you might reflect on the good qualities or imagine the good qualities. Imagine them, curled up in your lap. They're an animal or whatever. Just what makes you happy. And now really sense the qualities in your heart right now, qualities in your body. How do you feel? warm, spacious, quiet, smiley. And then some of the phrases that we use are words like may you be safe and protected. So you can say that to this person or animal. May you be safe, say it in your mind quietly. May you be safe and protected. May you be happy and peaceful. May you be healthy and strong. May you be at ease. Taking a breath. Notice how that feels. All right, and then we can come back. So I'm hoping you got a taste of it. However, I will say this. In these cultivation practices that cultivate the positive emotions, very frequently when we try to cultivate it, we don't have it. So something else happens. Maybe we bring up that loved one and then we're like, oh wait, they owe me $10. I'm mad at them because they never gave me the $10, right? And then it just hijacks everything. Or you do it and nothing happens. Or and this is normal. It's a part of it, and it's actually a really interesting part of it because we get to see what gets in the way of having these beautiful qualities of the heart. So this is without going into depth in the practice, but just for people who are, especially those who are newer, like getting a sense of what the kindness practice is. So let's talk about the second quality. The second quality is compassion. And compassion, is the translation of the word karuna, Karuna. And compassion is what happens when, so we open our heart with kindness, and when that open heart connects with somebody's suffering or pain, in best case scenario, there is an arising of this quality of compassion, which is this willingness to be present with the suffering and a genuine wish to alleviate it. And this could be other people's suffering or your own suffering. So it's different than kindness, because kindness is more just like, hey, be happy. I wish for you to be happy. Whereas compassion is, oh, you're suffering. May your suffering be alleviated. So it's a little heavier, because because in order to access it, we need to touch into the fact that that person is suffering. And we often can like merge the two. May you be happy, may you be free from suffering, right? They're not as discrete as this map is making it. So one of the things about compassion is that people feel that if they practice it, that they'll get overwhelmed by it. And people do get overwhelmed by other people's suffering, especially people who work in high stress situations, like the physicians that I'm working with, or we're all, I don't know, probably everybody's watching The Pit, right? You're watching The Pit. I mean, there's like a lot of compassion that's needed and a lot of burnout and overwhelm in these poor doctors. Anyway, I love the show. But there's actually just some research that came out recently saying that what overwhelms us is not compassion, but what they're calling empathic distress. And empathic distress is like feeling with another person's pain without any kind of stability or support. Like, I feel your pain, versus compassion is I feel the pain, but I feel also the desire to alleviate it. And so the research is showing that empathy alone activates pain networks in the brain, but compassion, when we add that extra piece of like the desire to have your suffering go away, or be alleviated in some way, it activates the caregiving and reward systems. So it's really different. It's really different. So empathy. I don't know. There was like literally just a study that came out the other day. I just saw it. That was saying that it's not compassion fatigue. Stop calling it compassion fatigue. It's empathy fatigue, because we're trying so hard to f feel with rather than feeling for, and making that extra effort to do, or at least to move in the direction of doing. So Again, people have difficulty with compassion towards themselves, and they might be able to have compassion towards others. Sometimes you can have compassion towards people you've never met in faraway countries. Sometimes it's impossible. Sometimes you read the news and you don't feel compassion, or you sometimes you feel great compassion. It changes and grows and is different at different times. And when we're exhausted, it's hard to feel compassion. And if we don't have compassion for ourselves, which a lot of people don't, it's often hard to feel compassion for others. So compassion, but compassion, like the other quality, can be cultivated, and that's a beautiful thing. And so you do it also by imagining and repeating words and phrases. And so let's give it a little mini compassion practice right this moment. So if you want to close your eyes, you can. You don't have to take a breath or two. Notice how you're feeling. And let's bring someone to mind who you love, who is suffering, but someone that it's fairly easy for you to feel compassion for. Okay, so anybody who comes to mind, and maybe not someone that's really intense they're suffering, but just, oh, my child got a bad grade and I feel bad for them, or that level sort of, just for right now, because we're only doing like a 1 minute meditation. Okay, so something I feel compassion for. I feel compassion for the birds in my yard, because they say, I don't know, for some reason. So just see what or who or what animal comes to mind, and take a moment to reflect on what it is they're suffering from. What is their pain? And just take a breath. And we can use some really simple language like, I care about your suffering. I care about your suffering. May your suffering be alleviated. May you be free from your pain and your sorrow. And as you say these words, notice what the feeling is like inside. And it's different. If you're able to distinguish that it's different than the may you be happy, it's something else. So just see if you can notice the difference. And if it starts to feel heavy, it's okay. We're going to come out of it for a moment, but just maybe send a little compassion to yourself even. May I be free from my challenges, from my suffering. And breathe. And then we'll open our eyes. So I haven't looked at the chat, and I see it's just a couple of, can empathy or compassion overwhelm a person such as caregivers? Well, I hope I was addressing that what they're saying now is that empathy can, for sure, but compassion, if it's like real compassion, won't, because it's connected to this action element of it. But I don't know. That's just what that scientific study said. I can link it if anybody's interested. Does compassion always arise when there's only suffering? No. I wish. When there's compassion, often doesn't arise when someone is suffering. In fact, oftentimes what arises is like the opposite, like aversion, get that away from me, or shutdown, or, and it's not that we're shutting down or we're reversive or we're walking away or something because we're like bad hearted or something. It's because our hearts are really tender, and it can feel too much. And so our systems shut down or want to get away from it or push it away. So so what we can learn to do with compassion practice and is to sort of titrate how much we let in a way that allows compassion to arise without overwhelming us. And also be honest and real when what's arising is not compassion. And be okay with that, and being compassionate to ourselves. And you're saying, Wendy's saying, I can we have compassion when it's not just suffering? Oh, yeah. Oh, I see what your question is. A little different than what I was asking, what I was answering. I mean, technically, compassion is connected to suffering because it's related to the, I mean, the definition of it is like, I mean, I think compassion, like to suffer with or something, but like the Latin root, but it's typically connected to when there's suffering arising and the desire to alleviate it. But we might have other qualities like the ones we're talking about that are really close. Like we might feel kindness, and maybe it's pretty close to compassion, right? The person's not suffering, so that's the way they relate to each other. All right. So, here's another question. Can you explain how compassion might work into a conversation where someone wants to fix us? How is this related to or different from wanting to alleviate the suffering? I'm not sure I quite understand the question because like I think, are you asking like someone's trying to fix us? And we could have a compassionate response versus having a like rejection of the person. I'm not 100% sure. Do you want to come
Sure.
on? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering, so often we'll have a conversation, or I'll have a conversation with a loved one, and I'll be wanting to share some suffering, and they'll respond by sort of not wanting to be with the suffering, and they'll like immediately jump into fixing it. So I was interested in how this might be different from that because it's the languaging around it is similar, but I think the intent is different.
Okay, excellent question. And now I understand. Yeah, so sometimes when we're struggling with something and we tell another person and they immediately go into fixing, that is not compassion. That is fixing. Someone wrote down below, that's control. Like that's them not wanting to feel. And oftentimes we want to fix another person because we don't actually want to feel their suffering because it's too intense, or we're scared of it, or, there's a million different reasons. So when someone is trying to fix you, I think it's often coming out of aversion and lack of compassion, almost like the opposite. And but no, I shouldn't say that. Let me think about it. I think a person may really want you to not be suffering, but their method for solving it is not that compassionate to you, right? Trying to fix you is not compassionate. And what might be helpful is just to say, hey, what I just want is for you to listen. And that's the most compassionate thing you can do for me right now. Right. So it's us being clear on what our needs are. It's a really interesting question. There's a lot in it, but does that give you enough to go on? Yeah. Okay, great. So, all right. So shall I go into all of them? Or are there more questions around kindness and compassion? You want to see how all four of them fit together and work? All right, let's see if I can do it before the end of the class. So the third one is what's defined as appreciative joy. Sometimes it's sympathetic joy. The word in the, this is the language in Buddhism. It's the Pali language, Pali, and it's mudita, Mudita. And appreciative joy is. It is now we have open-heartedness, and when it meets suffering, it becomes compassion. We have open-heartedness. When it meets happiness, it can become appreciative joy. It can also not become appreciative joy. So sometimes when we see somebody who has like a good fortune, our response is jealousy or covetousness or how come it happened to them or why didn't it happen to me, right? So the beautiful quality of the heart that we're trying to cultivate here is appreciative joy, which is taking joy, rejoicing in somebody's happiness and success. And it's actually a gorgeous state of mind. And instead of the mind going into envy and resentment and scarcity, the mind can actually go into a state of joy for another person's joy. So appreciative joy is not based in scarcity. It says like your joy does not diminish my joy. In fact, it expands the field of joy that's available to me. And oftentimes, someone is joyful about something and they're an easy person, not a person that we tend to get jealous about, but like it, my daughter was just in a play this weekend and I was like living in mudita in this appreciative joy. I was so happy. She did great. The children did great. The whole play was amazing. High school students doing Macbeth. It was like incredible. So that's my, so when it's easy, it's just the joy just multiplies and multiplies. It's a beautiful thing. But it's oftentimes that's not our first response. Oftentimes our first response is, oh, not in that situation, but like we hear a friend that had some good fortune and our first response might be, well, what about me? Or, well, they didn't deserve that or something, right? We can have that response to that. So let's just say a little bit more about it. Here's my favorite appreciative joy practice. It's very advanced, very, very, very advanced. And it's you're driving to get this happened to me literally yesterday. I was driving to get into a parking space. I pulled up in front of it, and this person slid in behind me. And so I did not go into appreciative joy. I went into that jerk took my parking space. And then I remembered appreciative joy. And I was like, stop. I took a breath and said, I'm happy for you. May your happiness and good fortune continue. Now, I was definitely fake it till you make it kind of at that moment. It wasn't like full on, but I did stop my mind from going into like a lot of like that jerk, where are they? I want to yell at them. That was my space. How could they do it? Feeling bad, feeling sorry. And maybe they really needed it more than I do. So parking space practice is an excellent one to do to practice this. And it doesn't mean ignoring injustice or inequality. It means not adding unnecessary suffering through comparison and allowing the goodness where it exists to be felt and shared. And it's so beautiful when we have that experience. Really, it's incredible. So, practices of gratitude and positive resonance, the science shows that it increases well-being, it strengthens relationships, it counteracts the negativity bias. So some of you know that the scientists talk about that, like our brain for things that are negative, our brain is like Velcro. For things that are positive, our brain is like Teflon. And that's called the negativity bias. We're biased towards threat, towards the negative. And so appreciative joy can be really like a rebalancing perception and rebalancing towards what is working, what is going well, and it can counteract that ne negativity bias. Okay, so let's take a minute or two to do a mini appreciative joy practice. So take a breath, go inside, connect with yourself. Notice how you're feeling. And now bring to mind someone, human or non-human, who is things are going well for them. Things are going well. Something good is happening in their life. And make it be an easy person or, somewhere where this quality is fairly easy to cultivate. So someone, things are going well. And now contemplate for a moment what's going well in their life. Notice what's happening inside you. And then we can say some really simple words. I'm happy for you. I'm happy for you. May your happiness and good fortune continue. May it grow and grow. May it never end. Notice. Just you can say whatever words you want. Let me your happiness continue. I'm so happy for you. Hooray. And then what's inside? What do you feel inside? Take a breath. That is appreciative joy. Okay, so open your eyes if they're closed. Feels good, right? It's nice. Now, it's much harder to do if I said, pick the person you're most jealous of, and we're going to practice appreciative joy. It's not easy. Then you have to really work at it. But in this case, it's fun. It's fun to practice. And someone said, I found it easy to be happy for someone's good fortune, except for the parking space thing. Exactly. As I said, I warned you, it was the advanced practice. Okay, fourth one is called equanimity. Also, the word is upekkha. It's the ground of that balance. And I've taught on equanimity in here quite a bit over the years, but equanimity is not indifference, and it's not apathy, and it's not disconnection, and it's not emotional shutdown. Equanimity is a steady, balanced mind that can be present in the face of whatever is arising. Non-reactivity. Equanimity, even-mindedness is probably the best translation. Even-mindedness. Although equanimity, it's not a word we use a lot, but it's a good word. So equanimity is a very profound quality of the heart because it's connected to deeper truths. And those deeper truths are things like we can't control anything. Outcomes are uncertain. Life includes gain and loss and praise and blame. Pleasure and pain, right? This is life. And when we start to see life and the changing nature of it, and that, like of the very famous equanimity line is this too shall pass, we start to have more balance and connection with ourselves. And it's and connection with others. When it's a very beautiful mind. Now it's cultivated through our meditation practice. The more you do through the mindfulness meditation practice, the more you do mindfulness, the more you are cultivating this quality of equanimity because you're not reacting to every thought, you're not every physical sensation you're not reacting to. You're learning this even-mindedness and balance. And it's also something we can cultivate through another kind of meditation practice. Equanimity is not the absence of care. It's really, there's a lot of, there's a depth of connection, but without that attachment to control connected to it. And it can balance out the other three that we talked about. It can balance out loving kindness, compassion, and appreciative joy. So if we get overly compassionate, so we burn, we're like, all we're doing is caring about everybody so much that we're barely functioning. We need to bring in equanimity. If we are so filled with joy that it's overwhelming ourselves or something, I don't know, we might need to use equanimity. I have a story from back in the day where I was teaching a bunch of teenagers. When I first started teaching, I started working with teenagers. And the teenagers had gone on a meditation retreat with us, and it was a 5-day retreat. And at the end of the retreat, they were sharing their beautiful experiences. And we had this kind of ritualized format where they'd come up and share their stories and ring a bell. And each teen had one beautiful story after the next, more and more amazing, more beautiful. It was so incredible. And I was sitting there and feeling like this amazing appreciative joy going through my body, just like, this is, and it started to feel like it was too much. I mean, I was like, I don't even think my body can contain this. And I leaned over to I turned to my colleague who was a senior teacher to me, and I said, how do I hold all this, this sympathetic joy, appreciative joy? And she turns to me and she leans over. She goes, equanimity, Diana, equanimity. And I had to bring that into balance. So the it's a beautiful quality, equanimity, that can be cultivated on its own. It's actually one of my favorite. Maybe my, no, I don't know if I have a favorite. So mindfulness and equanimity are associated with reduced emotional reactivity, more prefrontal cortex regulation, increased capacity to stay present under stress. So there's a lot of research looking at that. All right, we're going to try this last one, and then I'm going to talk about how they all fit together before we close. Okay. So let's do the equanimity. Let's take a pause, take a breath. Notice how you're feeling in this moment. So let's see if you can bring to mind a time when you might have had equanimity. When you had balance and even-mindedness, when you were, maybe you dealt with a situation way better than you thought you would or could. See if you can bring that to mind. Remember where you were. Remember how you dealt with it. Might have been a person that you handled really well, or you related to well. And if you can remember where you were and what happened, how did you feel in your body? How did you feel? What did equanimity feel like? Is it strong, centered, grounded, stable? And you can say some words if you want. I could be with things as they were. I could be with things as they were. I could handle life with equanimity. I felt balanced, connected. So, just reminding you of some of the qualities. Let's see if you feel it now. Maybe there's something you don't feel equanimity about. You might just say for just a moment, things are as they are. May I be with things as they are. You are as you are. May I be with you as you are. I am as I am. May I accept myself just as I am. Notice if there are any qualities present right now of equanimity. Take a breath, feet on the ground, open your eyes. So I see a few comments. One is, so did you touch into that equanimity quality? You know what I'm talking about? I mean, I'm hoping that you got a little flavor of all four of them. A friend who doesn't practice mindfulness uses the phrases, "It is what it is," and that seems to provide equanimity for her. Yes, you know, equanimity is not cornered of the market here in the meditation world. Equanimity is a quality of mind that a lot of people are going for. And, you know, people, it's really big in the 12-step movement, right? Accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, right? It's so on. That's equanimity, serenity. It's everywhere because it's a really important quality, and many of us have the desire to cultivate it. How can I deal with the all too often human traits of deceit, cheating, lying, and those highly negative lower practice? I think that's for another day. That's where we get to work on our react. We can't change those people, but we can work on our reaction to them, and we can also commit to being to emanating and developing and embodying these beautiful qualities to counteract the many, many people who are living in these states, as you said, of deceit, cheating, lying, and all of that. So let's just say I'll put that on hold for another time. What do I call these four things to practice again? Well, I'm calling them here the four beautiful qualities, but traditional Buddhism, they're called the Brahma Viharas, which maybe Serena can put into the chat for me. But they're also called the four immeasurables. Actually, that's maybe even a better here, I'll just put it in four immeasurables. Heavenly abodes. Okay, so four immeasurables, they're sometimes called, meaning they're boundless qualities of the heart. They cannot be measured. Four Brahma Viharas, the heavenly abodes. There's a scientist who I'm working with who's going to give a talk about the science behind these four practices. And he's calling it measuring the immeasurable, which I thought was very clever. The heavenly abodes, the places of the heart that we can dwell in that are so beautiful. So I just want to kind of conclude by putting it all together and say that these states can be practiced individually. We can practice them together. We can cultivate one very strongly, but sometimes the others get pulled in. We can practice them in daily life. We can practice them in, through meditation. There's so many ways to practice these four different qualities. And you probably may notice that you experience them throughout the day and you're not even so aware of it, but like, oh, wait, I just saw this child and it was so adorable and I just felt so much love for them. Okay, there's loving kindness right there. It just happened. So I encourage you to pay attention throughout the day. Wait, there's a so wait a minute. Can one ease into equanimity as a situation develops? We might start by freaking out and then gradually develop equanimity. Or is the goal to have it from the start at all times? It'd be nice to have it from the start at all times, but I think most of the time we do ease into it. You know what I mean? It's like these take practice. And even myself, who's been practicing these four qualities forever, I still got mad when that person took my parking space, but I reset, right? Reconnected. So the four qualities, in some sense, form a kind of a system of the loving kindness that creates warmth, the compassion that addresses pain or meets the pain, the appreciative joy that celebrates the goodness, and the equanimity that stabilizes everything. And when one is missing, they can get a little lopsided. So compassion without equanimity could be burnout. And equanimity without care or love or could be detachment. And joy without grounding could be fragility. I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at this, right? You can kind of play with them if they don't all show up. They balance each other out. But together, what they do is they create a resilient, flexible, and responsive heart. And so these are, as I said earlier in the very beginning, these are not ideals to perfect. They're not abstract qualities, and we're never going to perfect them anyway because they're immeasurable. They're boundless. You can keep the heart is enormous. It's like a giant, giant. I don't know what to say, like a geyser of potentiality. Like it just goes and goes and goes. You never get to the end of it. So that's the exciting thing. These are beautiful qualities that we can see throughout and develop throughout our life. And we do it with a lot of kindness and humility, and it's quite a beautiful practice, and it's a complement to what we do with the mindfulness practice. So that was a very long talk, but I wanted to get all four of them in for you. And thanks for your attention around all of this. I wanted to just let you know things that are up and coming at our center. So first of all, a couple of interesting things. One is that our app has been updated. It has had a redesign. It has new sections. So if you haven't looked at it lately, take a look. It's the same thing. It's just a little bit easier to easier to what's the word? Like, to navigate. Like they've done it, they've made it a little bit easier in some ways. Okay, so that's one thing. Upcoming classes. Let me tell you what's happening here. I can't remember who is next week, but on the 20th, I'm going to have Susan O'Connell with me, who's a Zen priest who's been developing a home, like not a home, like a center called Enzo Verde and Enzo Village, which are these like Zen inspired retirement communities. And she's, I mean, so some of you are not probably going to be interested in this, but some of you may be. She's going to talk on aging and bringing mindfulness into aging and this vision of like a kind of shared community life that is based in mindfulness and meditation practice. So she's coming in 2 weeks and I'll be there with her, sort of interviewing her. And then, you know, I started teaching a natural awareness class that's still open if you can, if you want to join, but it did start. And what else? Oh, on the end of the month, I'm doing a day long, an intro day long on mindfulness. And I think Serena's not going to be able to put any of these into the chat. So please just check out our newsletter and our website and see all the fun things that are coming up. I'm starting a study group, teaching a lot these days. So, and someone said, please have the four practices in the app. So they probably all are. If you were in the app, one of the things it has a very nice search feature. And hold on. It has a good search. And it says, I don't know if you can see, it says quick search. And then you could just put appreciative joy, equanimity, whatever. I'm sure I have all four of them in many different ways. Everything we do in here is put on the app. And there's lots for you to explore. And I think we're coming to the end. So I just want to send every, as we're looking at each other, send everybody a little kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, because we all can use it. I guarantee we all need all of them. All right. May you all be happy and peaceful and ease, everybody. Thanks so much for your attention. I'll see you in 2 weeks when I'm back with Susan. All right. Thanks.